apartheid legislation on the books in the country, the unbanning of the anti-apartheid groups in the country. Now, some of the conditions have arguably been met. Some have been only partially met, and some have not been met at all. The organizations have been unbanned. The state of emergency has been lifted in part, but one could suggest that even if it were lifted all across the country, the laws that that give it muscle still remain very much in place. In South Africa, it doesn't matter whether or not you have a state of emergency or not. That's just a measure of art. The law is very much there to give the police virtually the same power, the state of emergency notwithstanding. Then there's the question of the release of political prisoners. There's still many behind behind bars, and of course there's the argument about who is a political prisoner and who is not, and so that that's the question. Then the issue of the unbanning of political parties, while the government says that has been done, you still don't have free passage in and out of a country of people who belong to those parties. And so that raised questions about whether the unbanning is indeed authentic. We met last year with Secretary Baker to discuss this and had major or at least some suggestion that we will have some difference of opinion over the last condition that apartheid has to have been substantially dismantled. Of course, the other conditions are in the main objective conditions. This one, of course, is very subjective. And he indicated to us that that could be a matter over which we might disagree. There is no question that the Bush administration and President Bush himself want to lift these sanctions. And so they will attempt to interpret fulfillment of the conditions in a way that will allow them to do just that. The apartheid law is still very much on the book. Blacks cannot vote. The Group Areas Act is still in place. The Separate Amenities Act, the Internal Security Act, the Land Acts, all of these pillars of the apartheid system are still very much in place. And he essentially has done two things, largely of public relations value, released Nelson Mandela, and unbanned the ANC so that there's above-ground discussion, which has given him an image of a reformer that, in large part, is undeserved. That's not to suggest that he has been acting in good faith, in bad faith. That the point is that much of what he's promised to deliver remains undelivered, and until we see that delivery, I think it's premature of the president to invite him into the Oval Office, because he has restored him to the community of acceptable nations in so doing. And so I think we see a good deal of hypocrisy in American policy in this regard. We're prepared to lickety-split invade Iraq. We gave sanctions no real opportunity to work there when the very president, who's was such alacrity, wanted to move ahead in Iraq, opposed sanctions against South Africa and continues to do so. So I think we've got a very hypocritical president and a very hypocritical policy process in this regard. Particularly with respect to Iraq, since the very weapons our young men will be facing were supplied in large part by the United States, supported by the very president who now wants Mr. Saddam Hussein's head on a platter. But that's not new, isn't it? Noriega worked for us at one time, too, directly for President Bush. So it's important to remember that our policy seldom is rooted in any general morality that I can understand.
Trans Africa has initiated two programs, college programs, one at Lincoln University and the other at Spelman College. How did the initiation of those programs come about?
Well, they more than Lincoln and Spelman. As a matter of fact, they involve about 18 historically black colleges. But much of the leadership has come from Janetta Cole of Spelman, president of Spelman, and Niara Sadakis, the president of Lincoln University. Norman Francis down at Xavier in New Orleans has been very vigorous in this regard, too. The idea is to find young black men and women who want to pursue careers in foreign affairs. Even those who don't know they want to pursue careers in foreign affairs, to interest them, to make them aware that such careers are available to them, and to prepare them to take the Foreign Service exam, to get up the pass rate of blacks who take that exam. Again, as I was talking about in the press, if you expect to influence policy in media, in business, in foreign policy, anywhere you are in any sphere, you have to be in the room and you have to be well represented. And if we're going to do that in foreign policy, we're going to need more ambassadors, we're going to need more foreign service officers, we're going to need more people at the Agency for International Development, more people in the Congress, more people at the Commerce Department, at Treasury, the World Bank, the IMF, all of these places. We need to have our people representing as well, and we need to make our young people aware of these career opportunities. The only American government agency in the area of foreign policy that vigorously recruits on black campuses and on predominantly white campuses, vigorously recruits blacks, is the CIA, and that's indeed tragic. But what we've got to know, again, back to my notion that there's no point just copying about racism. For people who have power and abuse it, they don't cherish the notion of sharing it with anybody, so nobody's going to come looking for us saying that we've been hogging the decision-making process and we think this is wrong and might come and share it with us fairly. That's not how the game is played. We've got to discover how the world is run, and to demand our rightful place at the decision-making table, and that's a table with many chairs and many tables and many rooms, and we've got to be in all of them. And this program is to acquaint kids in college with this as a career opportunity and prepare them to take and pass this exam. It's a very difficult exam. And historically, we've had a very poor pass rate. But the others who take the exam have exam preparation courses. We've got to give our kids the same edge, and that's what we're doing with the historically black colleges now.
This program will also be on the elementary school level also?
In the long term, certainly at the high school level, because so much of the of whatever success you're going to have in taking this exam turns on your grasp of general information. It's not the kind of exam that you can prepare for well in a cram course. You might be asked where the Pyrenees are. You might be asked, where's Peru, or where's the Amazon, what's the largest river in the world, where is Xhosa spoken. You might be asked a range of things, the Ural Mountains, the Ba'ath political party, and all of these sorts of general information questions that you'd be best able to answer were you to start reading early on in the process. And so our young people really need to read Time and Newsweek and Emerge and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, read op-ed pieces, read foreign newspapers, read and read and read and read. And when you get towards your senior year in college and beyond, ready to take an exam like the Foreign Service exam, you'll find that all pays off. The black male in this country is in frightful danger. When you look at the figures of what's happening in our cities, and you've added to it crack cocaine, that not just jeopardizes the black male anymore, but the black woman. And children born into a world of crack bonding not possible between mother and child. All of these things are happening in the black community, a community where production of children is greater from the bottom than it is from the top. And so some sort of intervention is vitally necessary. And it starts with, I think, a good view of yourself. I mean, you can't have a worldview unless you have world information. And you can't be an activist on that level unless you have a positive view of yourself and your place in the general scheme of things. And I don't think we have that like we should. I think perhaps we're better than we used to be, but I still think we have an awful long way to go.
The late Randall Robinson, attorney, author, and founder of Trans Africa. Robinson died on March 24, 2023. He was 81. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez and Cliff Hargrove, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs.
And welcome to a special Labor Day edition of Book Bundle. I wanted to talk about a writer that I've been obsessed with for some time now, and that I had the honor of seeing one of his plays on Broadway. We guess I'm talking about Mabulu. Now, if you've never heard of Mabulu, that's because you haven't read the new book, August Wilson, A Life, by Patty Hartigan. Hartigan points out that he once had an African name when he went through his Black nationalist period. And I was shocked to find that out. But there's so many similarities that August Wilson has to so many other writers. And I want to get to that in a moment. So I want to talk a little bit about Hartigan's book, and then I want to read an extended excerpt from her book. So let's first talk about the author and the subject. The author is a former Boston Globe writer who's written extensively about plays and the theater, and she wrote this biography of August Wilson based on partly her extensive experience covering August Wilson. So there's so many things I learned. So for instance, August Wilson, all of these stories that come out of him, right? All these monologues that come out of him, right? Do they come out of the ether? No, not exactly. They're out of the stories of his family, along with ones that he's heard in, you know, the many bars and restaurants and diners that he wrote for decades. August found the blues as his soundtrack and score. He actually bought a collection of 5 cent 78 records, singles. Let's see. 78 records are not singles, are they? No, 78 are those old records. That's right. Forgive me, audience. Those old records, 78s. And like Baldwin, he was inspired by Bessie Smith's voice. There are historic names, of course, listed in this book, Larry Neal and Mary Baraka. I kept thinking about the similarities between August Wilson and Baraka. Both dropped out of school. Baraka dropped out of Howard. August Wilson dropped out of high school. They both did a stint in the service. They both attempted to write poetry. Of course, Baraka was more successful than August Wilson, but August Wilson had to find a space for his kind of poetry. August Wilson was inspired by Baraka, by the way, because they both straddled different worlds. Another similarity between him and many, many, many writers. He renamed. He was not Frederick August Kittle for his whole life. He decided to take out a typewriter and type out his new name. He created his name out of his family background. I mean, I found that quite fascinating. Like Baldwin, he stays away from the city he's writing about. He lives a lot of his life in Seattle and St. Paul, Minnesota. But artistically, he is attached to Pittsburgh the way Baldwin is attached to Harlem. Like Baldwin, he learned from the library. He spent 5 years in the library, Wilson did, after a black teacher challenged him on a paper and he dropped out of school. Wilson formed the Central Avenue Poets, went from poems to prose. There are mentions, of course, of him starting at the Black Horizons Theater and the Penumbra Theater in St. Paul. The Black Horizons Theater was a theater in Pittsburgh. Of course, his situation is filled with contradictions. He needed to be a black nationalist. He called for the development of black theater, but he never premiered his plays in black communities. Again, we mentioned the bars and the diners, but then we go from that to Eugene O'Neill, the Eugene O'Neill Center for Playwrights, and of course, its operator, Lloyd Richards, the very famous director of A Raisin in the Sun, and later the Yale Repertory Theater. And we see the various power struggles between the playwright and the director, which was Lloyd Richards, but later it would be Wilson, because Richards and Wilson would have a father-son spat, and Wilson would go on his own. And finally, the other part of the power struggle was with the producers. You know, Fences? I was really surprised to find out that Fences is basically the August Wilson equivalent of a pop single. He wrote it because he wanted people to believe that he could write a play with a regular structure and a hero and all of that. And so I'm just surprised. Like, it's his least favorite play. So, thinking again and again about this amazing personality, this amazing man, and how he created himself out of himself, I keep thinking about, you know, is his story outdated in 2023? My answer is hell yes and hell no. Today, we seem to be dealing with race and class and the arts by embracing them. So in 2023, elite college students of
This is a commentary on the Black World Media Network.
Hey, this is Bill Fletcher, former president of Trans Africa Forum, longtime trade unionist and writer, coming back to you today, which in the United States is Labor Day. And, you know, this is one of those interesting things that most of the world celebrates May 1st as Labor Day, International Workers' Day. The United States, for a whole host of reasons, not the least being a desire by the ruling elites to separate U.S. workers from the rest of the planet, came up with a September Labor Day. All right, such as it is. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about this particular moment here in the States is the increased interest in unions and the increasing levels of union organizing and militancy that we see around the country. And this is exciting. Public opinion and public support for unions hasn't been this high in years. Growing sympathy that has been spreading, you see whether it's the Starbucks workers, you see the militancy of the UPS workers, see the organizing of minor league baseball players, the United Auto Workers are gearing up for a potential strike. Number of things going on out there around the country. And obviously to that you must add Amazon, Amazon workers that have been organizing. Yet, what is missing is an overall strategy. A strategy for union renewal. So it's exciting to watch these organizing efforts, and I don't want to take anything away from them. But what we don't have a sense of is anything that comes close to what we saw in the 1930s and early 40s, where entire industries were being organized there was a coherent strategy that was underway. And on top of that, there was a connection between that organizing and other work, pro-democracy work that was taking place in the country, particularly anti-fascist work. And this issue of anti-fascist work has a special importance now with the growth of the so-called MAGA movement, the Make America Great Again movement, initiated by Trump, but has a long legacy. You could look at the Tea Party and other right-wing forces. And it's in this situation that it's all quiet on the union front. You have very few union leaders, and there's a few notable exceptions, but very few union leaders that are speaking up against the rise of right-wing authoritarianism. Many of them seem to be completely petrified at speaking up and would rather believe that workers can be united simply through hard-fought economic battles. It won't work that way. There is some real trade union militants who are also quite right-wing. And unless the leadership of organized labor is very explicit in its anti-right-wing authoritarianism and its anti-fascism, it leaves room for ambiguity in terms of what does the trade union movement stand for. So on the one hand, we need a very coherent organizing strategy that is particularly focused on the South and the Southwest, major areas of low union density. And this needs to take place in conjunction with social movements there on the ground. So that's one thing. And the other thing is a clear and unapologetic stand by the leadership, the leaders of organized labor, against the rising tide of right-wing authoritarianism. These two things must go together, or we're toast. This is Bill Fletcher signing off.
Keep listening to the Black World Media Network and hear outstanding commentaries from some of the finer minds of the diaspora.
On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs.
And welcome to a special Labor Day edition of Book Bundle. I wanted to talk about a writer that I've been obsessed with for some time now, and that I had the honor of seeing one of his plays on Broadway. We guess I'm talking about Mabulu. Now, if you've never heard of Mabulu, that's because you haven't read the new book, August Wilson, A Life, by Patty Hartigan. Hartigan points out that he once had an African name when he went through his Black nationalist period. And I was shocked to find that out. But there's so many similarities that August Wilson has to so many other writers. And I want to get to that in a moment. So I want to talk a little bit about Hartigan's book, and then I want to read an extended excerpt from her book. So let's first talk about the author and the subject. The author is a former Boston Globe writer who's written extensively about plays and the theater, and she wrote this biography of August Wilson based on partly her extensive experience covering August Wilson. So there's so many things I learned. So for instance, August Wilson, all of these stories that come out of him, right? All these monologues that come out of him, right? Do they come out of the ether? No, not exactly. They're out of the stories of his family, along with ones that he's heard in, you know, the many bars and restaurants and diners that he wrote for decades. August found the blues as his soundtrack and score. He actually bought a collection of 5-cent 78 records, singles. Let's see. 78 records are not singles, are they? No, 78 are those old records. That's right. Forgive me, audience. Those old records, 78s. And like Baldwin, he was inspired by Bessie Smith's voice. There are historic names, of course, listed in this book, Larry Neal and Mary Baraka. I kept thinking about the similarities between August Wilson and Baraka. Both dropped out of school. Baraka dropped out of Howard. August Wilson dropped out of high school. They both did a stint in the service. They both attempted to write poetry. Of course, Baraka was more successful than August Wilson, but August Wilson had to find a space for his kind of poetry. August Wilson was inspired by Baraka, by the way, because they both straddled different worlds. Another similarity between him and many, many, many writers. He was not Frederick August Kittle for his whole life. He decided to take out a typewriter and type out his new name. He created his name out of his family background. I mean, I found that quite fascinating. Like Baldwin, he stays away from the city he's writing about. He lives a lot of his life in Seattle and St. Paul, Minnesota. But artistically, he's attached to Pittsburgh the way Baldwin is attached to Harlem. Like Baldwin, he learned from the library. He spent 5 years in the library, Wilson did, after a black teacher challenged him on a paper and he dropped out of school. Wilson formed the Central Avenue Poets, went from poems to prose. There are mentions, of course, of him starting at the Black Horizons Theater and the Penumbra Theater in St. Paul. The Black Horizons Theater was a theater in Pittsburgh. Of course, his situation is filled with contradictions. He needed to be a black nationalist. He called for the development of black theater, but he never premiered his plays in black communities. Again, we mentioned the bars and the diners, but then we go from that to Eugene O'Neill, the Eugene O'Neill Center for Playwrights, and of course, its operator, Lloyd Richards, the very famous director of A Raisin in the Sun, and later the Yale Repertory Theater. And we see the various power struggles between the playwright and the director, which was Lloyd Richards. But later it would be Wilson, because Richards and Wilson would have a father-son spat, and Wilson would go on his own. And finally, the other part of the power struggle was with the producers. You know, Fences? I was really surprised to find out that Fences is basically the August Wilson equivalent of a pop single. He wrote it because he wanted people to believe that he could write a play with a regular structure and a hero and all of that. And so I'm just surprised, like it's his least favorite play. So thinking again and again about this amazing personality, this amazing man, and how he created himself out of himself, I keep thinking about, you know, is his story outdated in 2023? My answer is hell yes and hell no. Today, we seem to be dealing with race and class and the arts by embracing them. So in 2023, elite college students of all races become MFA professors. MFAs are the Masters in Fine Arts. Those are the equivalents of the doctorate in arts. And they write and pay bills all along the way. This kind of romantic poverty that August Wilson lived in. I remember hearing stories about how he would get evicted every 3-4 months and have to drag his record collection with him every 3-4 months when he moved into another place. I mean, all of that is kind of passé, correct? Well, I would say so if it wasn't for this Writers Guild strike, because it looks like the starving artist cliche is passé, but if you read articles about this WGA strike, I mean, food pantries in California, and then you have these openly hurting playwrights who wrote for TV and film in order to not suffer for their art. Both the pantries and the playwrights are feeling serious pinches as Hartigan releases his book. Playwriting then seems to be a loving, lyrical curse, inflicting pain to focus the mind. Freedom is indeed never free, and labor is ever subjected to exploitation. Like his characters, August struggled from constraints. His talent will be rarely equaled, but his determination for pure art, what he called, quote, the blood's memory, end quote, needs to be bottled and sold. So now I want to read an excerpt, an extended excerpt from August Wilson, A Life by Patty Hartigan. I want to read the prologue. The book begins with an epigraph by August Wilson. To arrive at this moment in my life, I've traveled many roads, some circuitous, some brambled and rough, some sharp and straight, and all of them have led, as if by some grand design, to one burnished with art and small, irrevocable tragedies. Again, that's the epigraph from August Wilson. On March 22, 2003, under a somber gray sky, August Wilson walked slowly up the steps of St. Benedict the Moor Church, the grand, imposing Roman Catholic cathedral on Crawford Street at the base of Pittsburgh's Hill District. The temperature was in the low 50s, typical for early spring in Pittsburgh, but an unforgiving drizzle added a nip to the air. Wilson had cut short a trip to Syracuse to be back in Pittsburgh that day. He sported a black turtleneck and a brown tweed jacket, topped by a trench coat to keep away the chill. His signature Borlasano fedora shadowed the deep circles under his puffy eyes. His neatly trimmed beard was more salt than pepper. He hadn't originally planned on spending the day back home in Pittsburgh. His latest play, Gem of the Ocean, was about to make its world premiere in less than a month at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. He had finished a very rough draft, and he would rewrite during rehearsals the same way he had revised the other plays in his ambitious 10-play cycle about African Americans in the 20th century. Gem was the 9th play in the cycle. He had one more to go, and he already felt the pressure of completing the goal he had set for himself so long ago. He had also foolishly agreed to write and perform a one-man autobiographical show for a benefit fundraiser at the Seattle Repertory Theater. He hadn't written a word, and he had just 2 months left before he had to get up on stage and play himself as a young man. He was a perennial procrastinator, but standing on the steps of that church, looking up toward the Hill District, he was burdened by grief and memories, many of them painful. He had mourned his mother, Daisy Wilson, at this very church 20 years ago, almost to the day. He knew he was going to pay tribute to her in his one-man show, and he had already thought about what to say. "There will come a day when you will suffer the most profound grief imaginable," is what he eventually wrote. "And you look up and find out all them years you've been living in your mother's prayers, and now you've got to live on your own." This church, so noble and grand, evoked images from the past. As a boy, Wilson had attended the parochial school at Holy Trinity in the Lower Hill District, but the school was demolished during an ill-informed period of urban renewal in the late 1950s. Several parishes merged to form St. Benedict the Moor, named for an Italian Franciscan friar who was born of African slaves and celebrated for his charity. The church commissioned a giant statue of its patron saint in 1968, the same year as the assassination of Martin Luther King. The 18-foot-tall landmark faces with its arms stretched in welcome to the people of downtown Pittsburgh, its back turned on the Hill District. The orientation of the statue of a saint with African blood turning its back on his people had infuriated Wilson the day it was unveiled. It still did. But he was here to bury one of his friends, not to resurrect old grievances. Wilson never missed a funeral. His life and his work reinforced the notion that attention must be paid to history, to ancestral roots, to family, and to friends, both celebrated and obscure. He stopped briefly outside the church to greet Nate Smith, the legendary labor leader who had famously laid down in front of a moving bulldozer in 1969 to protest the absence of black union workers at the Three Rivers Stadium construction site. Smith's bald head glistened, his mournful eyes rimmed red. Wilson had been an impressionable young man in his early 20s when Smith led thousands in protest marches in downtown Pittsburgh, ultimately forcing the mayor and the union leaders to develop a plan to admit blacks and women into the city's entrenched trade unions. Smith was one of his heroes back then, but today the two men met as peers, fellow mourners. While Smith was organizing protests, Wilson was living in a shady basement apartment on Crawford Street, just a block over from St. Benedict's. He was an inspiring young poet, a high school dropout who loved words as much as he loved the sweet smell of a woman's perfume in the late night hours. He wrote poetry on a manual Royal Standard typewriter. That typewriter had been replaced long ago, and the apartment building had been demolished. But he had forged deep friendships with his fellow poets back then. He had found his vocation right there on those streets by becoming one of a quartet known as the Center Avenue Poets. Charlie Williams, Nicholas Flournoy, Rob Penny, and Wilson. Swept up in the Black Nationalist Movement, they aimed to change the world with poetry and plays by giving the people a voice. And that is what brought Wilson, now an acclaimed playwright, winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes, a Tony Award, and numerous honorary degrees, to the steps of this church, not far from where he had grown up, the son of a single mother in a 2-room flat with no indoor plumbing. He was back home to bury Rob Penny. A small, wiry man with an infectious grin, Penny had preceded Wilson at Central Catholic High School, the elite exam school in Oakland, a neighborhood that's a stone's throw from Carnegie Mellon University and miles away in mindset from the Hill District. Despite rampant racism at the school, Penny had been able to succeed because he was the fastest runner on the track team, and whip smart, too. Wilson was accepted 2 years after Penny's graduation. He withdrew after barely a year, tired of the racist notes that were left on his desk and the jokes played at his expense. Penny graduated and was a celebrated star athlete. Years later, Wilson saw him take a dare from a group of teenagers hanging out in a park. The upstarts thought they could beat the old man with the graying dreadlocks in a 100-yard dash. Penny won. He always won. The 2 former Central Catholic students had been brothers back when they were aspiring young artists. They had bonds. They had a past together. Back in the 1960s, Penny called himself Brother Oba, which means king in the Yoruba and Bini languages of West Africa. Wilson took the name Babulu, the name of a town in Tanzania. Together in 1968, the 2 men launched Black Horizons Theater, creating art from the ashes of the fiery demonstrations at Rock Pittsburgh after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. They were poets and dreamers who subscribed to the principles of Amiri Baraka's Black Arts Movement, which espoused that theater and art could empower the Black community. Penny was able to turn his poetry acumen and community activism into a teaching slot at the University of Pittsburgh's newly formed Department of Africana Studies in 1969. There was no place for Wilson in the department, but he didn't begrudge his friend his good fortune. Penny, at least, had graduated from high school. Wilson continued to struggle as a penniless poet and playwright for many years while Penny enjoyed the perks and acclaim of the Academy. Penny went on to become chairman of Africana Studies in 1978, serving until 1984 and remaining an esteemed professor until his death of a heart attack on March 16, 2003. Wilson, on the other hand, worked every odd job from dishwasher to short order cook. His first nibble at theatrical success came in 1982, when his play Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was accepted to be developed at the prestigious Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut. He included his Pittsburgh friends in that small amount of triumph. Penny and another Pitt professor, Curtis Porter, traveled to Waterford to see the play. Wilson continued to invite his Pittsburgh brothers to his Broadway openings, and he also celebrated their achievements over the years. Back in the day, Penny had taken to wearing dashikis, while Wilson wore musty tweed sports coats he brought at the St. Vincent de Paul thrift shop. A coat went for 35 cents, and a tie cost a nickel. Now his tweed had a better pedigree, but Wilson still related to the young man who shopped the bargain stores. Before Wilson set foot in the church, Penny's family sent a message to him. All the mourners were invited to say a few words about the departed, except August Wilson. Wilson believed in speaking well of the dead. He spoke at funerals of folks he barely knew, impoverished street characters he gave a few bucks to when they were down in their luck. Not speak at Rob's funeral? He told his younger brother, Richard Cattell, that he was crushed. Many of his contemporaries saw him during the services and noticed that his legs buckled ever so slightly. His lips sank downward, making his mustache seem like a deep frown. Sally Goodine, an actor from the old days who had gone on to a career in local politics and activism, saw the normally self-restrained Wilson weep openly over the coffin. Mark Clayton Southers, an aspiring playwright, noted that Wilson was inconsolable. He didn't know that his idol, August Wilson, had been silenced because of his own success. Wilson was aware that the people who had been his dearest friends in the old days resented his acclaim. Some of them had suggested to one another privately that he had somehow sold out because of his commercial success on Broadway. When he gave his controversial speech, "The Ground on Which I Stand," in 1996, he was shattered that many of his friends from the theater failed to support him publicly. The fiery speech called for the creation of more Black theaters and denounced colorblind casting as demeaning to blacks. Many of the Wilson warriors, the actors who made their livings performing in his plays, were silent. That stung Moore. Wilson had noticed over the years that the more successful he became, the more distant his former brothers grew. Poet Nick Flournoy, however, had remained true to their friendship, even as he continued to work primarily as a community activist. But Wilson knew others questioned his loyalties. He knew they envied his success. But he also knew that he was still the guy who wrote in basements and restaurants, even if he could afford the penthouse suite. His reception at the funeral accentuated the conflicting emotions about the city he celebrated in his plays. "I have this love-hate relationship with Pittsburgh," he once said. "This is my home, and at times I miss it and find it tremendously exciting, and other times I want to catch the first thing out that has wheels." When he exited the church with his fellow mourners, he had trouble containing the deep lump in his throat and the steady flow from his watery eyes. A crowd had gathered at Freedom Corner, directly across the street from the church. Wilson was just a boy in the 1950s when developers encroached on the lower part of the Hill District, threatening to destroy the bustling, multi-ethnic enclave where he grew up. The developers razed the lower hill to put up the civic arena, displacing thousands of people and creating a wasteland of urban blight. In the 1960s, protesters put up signs saying, "No redevelopment beyond this point," drawing a line at the corner of Center Avenue and Crawford Street. The spot became known as Freedom Corner, a place where protesters gathered to begin marches for social justice and racial equality. Nate Smith had launched many of his protests there. His name was inscribed along with those of other civil rights leaders in the monument that was finally built on the spot in 2001. Wilson's younger cousin, Renee Wilson, his Uncle Frank's daughter, whom he barely knew, but who had grown up to be a crackerjack community activist, had called him sometime earlier. She had organized a group called People Against Police Violence to protest the deaths of five black men killed by Pittsburgh police. She had scheduled a demonstration for March 22nd. The victims' stories sounded like anecdotes from a Wilson play. One of the dead was a 12-year-old boy who was shot in the back while fleeing from police after a car robbery. Renee Wilson was dedicated to the cause of No Justice, No Peace, and she asked her famous cousin to attend the protest. He declined her request. He had planned to be in Chicago on that day, working on his play. Renee had also called Rob Penny. She had taken a writing class with him at Pitt, and he had encouraged her to keep writing poetry. She asked that he speak at the rally. He agreed to attend, but he would not speak. As it turned out, Penny was there, but in a coffin. Renee had planned on starting the march downtown earlier in the day, but out of respect for Penny, she postponed the beginning of the demonstration until after the funeral. Wilson must have been aware of the symbolism of the moment. Like his cousin, he had harbored dreams of changing the world, but he had had to leave Pittsburgh to do it. He had walked those same streets when he was a young man, but even though he had almost accomplished what he set out to do when he started writing his cycle of 10 plays, some of his former friends had branded him as the one who had turned his back on the community, just like that statue of St. Benedict the Moor. The hearse went one way, and the protesters another. Wilson had written plays that dramatized the reasons for the protest his cousin was leading. He had done his part. He had found his song and shared it with audiences all over the world, but he hadn't expected to pay such a high personal price. He looked across the street at the protesters and looked at the hearse. He followed the funeral procession. It was time for another generation to take over the struggle. So that's the prologue of August Wilson, A Life, written with great vest, as you see, by Patty Hartigan. I think it's the first major biography of August Wilson. I hope it won't be the last, but if it is the last, this is a very good biography to go out on. I would also recommend the August Wilson PBS documentary that you can find on Amazon Prime and other places that stream PBS documentaries. Thank you for spending part of your Labor Day with me. For the Black World Media Network, I'm Todd Stephen Burroughs.
That was Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats, presented by reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs, journalist, historian, and popular culture enthusiast.
As we go back, check out our musical legacy. And for your enjoyment, we got different people coming up, like Marvin Gaye, Lee Fields, the Teskey Brothers, Duran Jones, Kubia, Lady Ray, Yola, and more. This is 1-to-1 for Sunday.
Distant lover. Together, the promises we made over time.
Oh, you just plain mean to the woman, and that's a crying shame. You just plain mean to me, woman, and that's a crying shame. Since you've gone away and left me, honey, I've been crying with the pain. Oh, I'd do most anything to feel your love just once again. Oh, I'd do most anything to feel your love just once again. But that day it never comes, babe. That's why I'm crying with the pain. Babe, and you treat love just like a game. You're just like a little child, babe, and you treat love just like your own game. But you never really loved me, honey. That's why I'm crying with the pain. Yeah, I'm crying with the pain. Most every night and every day. Every night, every day, yeah. It was just three words I wanna hear from you, baby, and those are three words you never say.
I've been looking at you all night.
Your place, ooh, your place. Pushing me away, so I'm leaving. Will everyone please rise? 'Cause in this court, the judge of love resides. Will the jury take its place? Now, will the plaintiff kindly state his case?
I got a letter today and cried with every word she had to say. I was so hurt, shame and disgrace, for that woman didn't have the nerve to tell me face to face that she was seeing somebody else. And all my witnesses testified to how I felt. She didn't tell me she was gonna let me go. I was the last one alive. So my first charge is that she deceived me into thinking that her love was mine, all mine. The second charge is that she misused me and abused my love. And just believe me, that's a crime. That she was dishonest and stripped me of all my manly pride. She constantly disrespected me, and somehow I always seemed to catch a line.
As the jury reached its verdict,
and I tensed up so sad. Yeah.
We have, Your Honor.
Somebody tell me, what's it gonna be?
We find the defendant guilty as charged.
I got justice.
I'm glad I ran into you today. Now, while you're alone, which is not that often, I want you to take a minute and listen to what I have to say. Remember the quarrel we had and I told you to get out and find someone else, which you did. And when I saw you both together, I would smile and give you a convincing hello. And remember once you told me that I had no feelings at all? Well, please, baby, please listen to what I have to say.
So you think my heart's bad and strong? I know you do, baby. And when you're near me, there's no reaction. Well, you're wrong. Lord knows you're wrong. Oh, come from the tip of my toes. My love for you steadily grows on and on. Oh, baby, each day you're not here. Lord, I'm soaking wet with my tears. Yeah, but not on the outside.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
From around 1874-75 till 1908, it was just a convict lease system there. So most of the fields were worked by convict labor. Mm-hmm. And then in 1908, a couple of the huge plantations went into receivership, which I guess means they were so in debt they had to change ownership. Yes.
Right, exactly.
And that's when the Imperial Sugar Company took over, and they sold one of the huge plantations to the state of Texas, the plantation where these 95 bodies were eventually found. They sold it to the state of Texas to run a state-run prison farm. So it was the same as convict leasing, but now the state was completely in control of it. And when they sold it, the contract said, okay, this is your land, but any sugar cane you harvest, you have to sell it to the Imperial Sugar Company. Mm. And that's how Imperial kept profiting from convict labor, even after the convict lease system ended around 1910, 1912.
Brittany Martin, co-host and executive producer of Sugarland. Sugarland is an 8-episode podcast that explores how the discovery of a cemetery forced the city to confront its history and the 95 African-American individuals unearthed during the construction in Sugarland, Texas, 30 miles southwest of Houston. In 2018, a construction team was building a new school in Sugarland. There, workers discovered something shocking, an unmarked cemetery containing 95 bodies. The individuals buried there are believed to be part of a convict leasing program that began in the late 1800s. Ranging in age from 14 to 70, the inmates had muscular builds, but were malnourished, their bones misshapen from back-breaking repetitive labor. They were buried in plain pine boxes between 1878 and 1911. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Sugarland, the podcast with co-host and executive producer Brittany Martin, In Black America.
We've been through so many different versions of this story. Mm-hmm. I think for Naomi and I, we really had to learn the history before we could go further into what happened over the past 5 years. So that involved going to the Texas State Archives, archives in all kinds of parts of the state, state archives everywhere, North Texas and Houston and Austin, and just digging through these handwritten cursive reports, trying to make sense of this history and get it all straight in our heads. And then we could sort of tell the story that was unfolding in Sugarland. By sort of going back, we started working on it in 2021, early 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And the cemetery was found in 2018. So we had a bit of hindsight, which benefited us a lot when we were trying to tell a more complete story of the Sugarland 95.
The 95 African Americans have become known collectively as the Sugarland 95. And in November 2019, they were laid to rest at the site where their remains were originally found. The gravesite dates back to the years after the Civil War, when hundreds of African-American men were sent to convict labor camps in the area to harvest sugarcane. Activist and former corrections officer Reginald Moore had warned local and state officials that remains were buried in and around Sugarland, but officials weren't listening. But as fate would have it, in early 2018, construction at the site of the Fort Bend ISD New James Reese Career and Technical Center unearthed a forgotten piece of Sugarland's past, an historic cemetery where 95 individuals were buried. Sugarland, the investigative 8-episode podcast series from the Texas Newsroom, explore this well-kept secret. Recently, In Black America spoke with co-host and executive producer Brittany Martin. Ms. Martin, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're born and raised.
I was